Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Quarter Report. This is our third quarter report with the Saker, the emerging multipolar world, and things are so explosive. I emailed him and said, can we do it early? I can't. I'm so eager to talk with you. So, Saker, welcome to the Solari Report.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always is a real joy and pleasure for me.
You have now published The Essential Saker number 3, and I'm very excited because it means I get to read another Saker book. But tell us a little bit about it and where we can get a hold of it.
You can get a hold of it on my website, which will redirect you to the Saker community website where you can order it. It's the third book, and it covers pretty much, it's actually the biggest of all three. It's really thick. It's over 800, just over 800 pages. And why? Because it covers, I think, an extremely important but also extremely dangerous period, which is basically the 2017-18 period, where I think last year we came very, very close to a possible war. So it's a big book and covers a lot of important material. I think it's the most important one of the three, for sure.
So let's just pick up where we left off with war in Iran. Tell us what has happened since we talked last, and where you think we are right now in terms of the effort, clearly by a variety of interests, to start another serious escalation in the Middle East.
Well, we've been, it's a back to the future kind of scenario. We're back to threats. I mean, Iran has been the object of threats of all sorts of kinds from the Anglo-Zionists literally since the Islamic Revolution. The U.S. had several goes at trying to, coerce Iran to do this or that. I think Trump clearly wanted to try the same approach as he did with Syria, with North Korea, Venezuela, maximal threat, maximal tension, statements. I mean, it looks like the war is about to start, and then it doesn't. And the question is, how do we explain that? I mean, some people say that Trump personally... Well, he said that he didn't want to kill innocent Iranians, which I think is laughable, considering that the United States has killed, literally millions of people abroad under both Trump and, right. And Obama. And he here suddenly turned humanitarian. And there was this report that actually, I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds ridiculous enough to be true, that Trump actually made a request to bomb some segment of Iran where the government wouldn't mind, sort of to save face, and the U.S. turned down. I think, considering the current level of incompetence of the governments in the United States, I would not say that this is unthinkable. I think we're dealing with essentially a completely decapitated power. That's how I see the U.S. right now, with no policy whatsoever. So the substitute for it is flag waving and making all sorts of roaring threats. I can stop this war in 10 days, but I don't want to kill 10 million people, that kind of stuff. It's just... complete. There's such a distance, such a chasm between the real world and the nonsense that comes out of Washington, D.C. They seem to be completely oblivious to the fact that they're losing the empire. And I think that's big news.
So we have the British Navy showing up in the Straits of Hormuz and now getting involved with sort of tanker warfare back and forth. What is the British role?
The usual, it's being basically a poodle. There's no other role for that. Getting British warships inside the Strait of Hormuz basically makes them perfect targets and very easy targets to engage. So as I said many times, if the Empire gets serious about attacking Iran, expect them to flush all their ships out of the Persian Gulf and not put them in. When you put them in, it's the same deal as when the U.S. starts parading its ships in the Black Sea. It makes no military sense whatsoever. It's purely a political show. There's nothing of substance to it in terms of protecting. We can't protect anything.
So one of the things that makes me nervous, one, we've talked many times about how unthinkable a land war would be and how unwinnable a war with Iran is. But if you look at the politics of the interests who are trying to engineer war with Iran as they sort of pop up in the U.S., there's clearly in U.S. politics an incredible war going on, and it's impossible to see it clearly. So we don't need to discuss it, but we've just had the fifth New York policeman shot in the head. It's said to be a suicide, but, to me, it's clearly not. We just had a fire district in New York. The seven commissioners issue a resolution saying that the World Trade Center buildings came down through internal demolitions and they want a new investigation, which has to be one of the most courageous acts in American politics of the last two decades. So you can see there's tremendous tension about what has been going on to engineer war in the Middle East. Now, it's impossible to tell, you know, what's really going on behind the scenes, but clearly there are people who want war with Iran and are willing to do suicidal things with the U.S. empire to get it. And the question is, you know, why do they not stand down? Why are they willing to rush into a suicidal mission?
Well, there are a couple of reasons for that. It's all sort of create a perfect storm. Obviously, Israel wants Iran to be as hurt, you know, as hit as hard as possible. The only right. people who really are lobbying hard for a war with Iran have always been the Israelis and their agents here in the United States. But besides that, there's several other things. I mean, there is this problem that the United States military is not a credible threat anymore. It cannot be used effectively to sway anybody to do anything. I mean, after the U.S. military, you know, really growled and showed muscle in front of Venezuela, and then Venezuela didn't cave in, I mean, that's really terminal. I mean, that leaves maybe Liechtenstein, Monaco, and you know, the Vatican as tiny states that might still be persuaded to be afraid. But the rest of them, absolutely not. And that's a huge problem for the United States, because what is the dollar backed by nowadays? I say it's backed only by aircraft carriers. And these aircraft carriers are not credible. They don't represent a threat, you know, that can actually get political goals achieved. So that's the second reason. One of the reasons to attack Iran is to sort of prove that the U.S. is still the big guy on the block and the indispensable power, the best military in world history, and all the rest of the hot air that we know so well. You know, you need a real victory of some kind, even if it's largely fictional, to prop it up. It's not dissimilar to the rationale for Israeli strikes on Syria. I mean, the main purpose right. of these strikes right now is to prove that they can still do strikes. Never mind what they don't hit anything of relevance, but they still do strikes, so they save their face again by saying, you know, we kicked them, we hit them. There's the same thing happening here. And a couple of days ago, the U.S. claimed that they shut down an Iranian drone. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah, I saw it.
It's so obviously, it's you know, it's literally kindergarten level face saving. It's very, very pathetic.
Right. Right. It you know, but it's funny. You see the headlines go back and forth, and you don't. It's hard to really know what's the truth and what's not. I don't know if you just saw the allegation by, it appears to be Iran, that the Israelis had assassinated Amano, the man at the UN who oversaw the nuclear inspections. Is that correct?
No, I didn't see that, but that would be very typical.
Right.
I don't know if you want to see what the truth is. I mean, recently, let me look, on the 17th of July, Syed Mohammed Marandi wrote a very good article in the Moon of Alabama, highly recommended. It's called A U.S.-Led Naval Coalition, the Persian Gulf Will Raise the Threat of War. And Professor Marandi explains that the Iranian position is to hit disproportionately back if they are hit, thereby deterring. I mean, they have developed a very sophisticated policy of deterrence, and it's actually an extremely effective one. If you think about it, I mean, from the Islamic Revolution to today, Iran has never been attacked directly and hard by the U.S. and the Israelis. They've been attacked by the entire world by means of Saddam Hussein, and they succeeded in very hard conditions to prevail. But his idea is that, you know, that is the policy of deterrence. We hit hard, you know, full spectrum and very hard if you even attack us with a limited attack. And I don't know if that's the case, but I have no reason to distrust Professor Marandi. And I think it's a very, very good deterrence policy. I think they're very smart.
So I had assumed that the logical strategy, given the power that Israel has within the U.S. coalition, was to just squeeze with economic sanctions. So the question is, can that get the U.S. anywhere?
Well, first of all, let's just always go through the basics. Sanctions, unilateral sanctions, or even by a group of countries against another sovereign nation, are illegal. They're a violation of international law, and they're basically an act of war. So let's just, it's always important to keep that in mind, because the word sanction sounds like, you know, daddy caught his little boy stealing from the cookie jar, and he told him to copy five times, I won't steal from the cookie jar. That's sort of the, you know, the emotional contents of the word sanction. It's not, no big deal. What we're talking about it here is provoking a country by engaging in illegal act of war. I just want to make sure that this is clear before we go any further.
Right, but don't you think that it's absolutely clear globally that the U.S. is violating international law in many different arenas?
Yes, I do believe that. I think that the Kristallnacht for international law was the bombing on the Bosnian Serbs in 1991, and ever since, international law has been completely disregarded, you know, trampled upon. Even the most sacred principles of international law are completely ignored, and that paradoxically is good news. Because what it is, it's the empire showing its true face. If you look, for instance, even at the time of Obama, you know, Obama had the charm of, I always say, the car salesman. And he was trying to pretend that he had some respect for, say, the European allies. Whereas Trump, he doesn't have even the manners to do that. I mean, he's totally straightforward in his, you know, he despises everybody. Look what he's saying to praise Macron, and now he's saying that they're doing extremely foolish things. I mean, he's getting in fights with everybody. And that's just due to an inability to operate in that function. I think him and Zelensky are the two examples of people who are completely clueless. And as a result, there's complete chaos.
Well, here's what was interesting. Bush was clearly far outside the international law. Obama was clearly far outside of international law. Clinton was certainly, as a matter of policy, planning to be. But there's something about Trump's style. You know, he's very forthright about being outside of international law. And somehow that seems to finally make it clear.
Well, I think it's more than just international law. I think that the empire has essentially completely given up on all the fundamental ideological building blocks, if you want, of the Western society. Concepts such as democracy, human rights, freedom of speech, pluralism, all that gone. We're now in a society which basically might makes right. Ideology primes everything, and reality has absolutely no bearing on anything. It's a terminal stage for an empire to enter that phase. I mean, it's absolute. The comparison that I have in my mind would be maybe the Kerensky regime in Russia in 1917. I mean, we're talking about such an overwhelming inability to get anything done that, you know, regular analyses of ideology, of politics, just don't apply anymore.
Well, I hate to say this, FASB 56 probably was the death knell. Because if you're saying, you know, we reserve the right to fake our books, I think that's, you know, that's crossing a clear line about your inability to function.
Yeah. We see the exact same towards every problem, really. The problems are basically not being tackled. Loud statements are made around some issue, and then, you know, the interest goes on something else. But I absolutely fail to see any kind of policy actually working. None.
So the latest development is Coates has just been resigned, and we see a Texas congressman from the 4th District, name circulated as the new director of intelligence. Now, it's not somebody I'm familiar with. Now, the 4th District is a location for a tremendous number of defense contractors. So there's big money to be made in the 4th District by having wars or the danger or the appearance of war. But it seems to me you're moving out the people who could say, no, this is a mistake, and putting in the people who are going to go along. So the name being circulated, I think it's John Ratcliffe, was one of the sponsors of the 2016 Israeli cybersecurity bill, integrating U.S. and Israeli cybersecurity commands. So, you know, this looks like a guy who's going to go, you know, who's on board for the plan, whatever the plan is. In other words, you're losing the adults in the room, and you're getting the guys who are going to cheerlead for whichever way the power wants to go.
Yes, it's absolutely true. I mean, there's no doubt about it. Recently, a couple of weeks ago, Andrew Basevich wrote a very good article called The Decline of Our Nation's Generals, and actually reprinted it on my blog, which he describes that phenomenon, you know, looking at generals, but you could look at civilian people, and you have exactly the same.
It's a very significant problem in the civilian bureaucracy, that I know, just from having worked in it. So let's talk a little bit about Tulsi Gabbard, because one of the things I've been following is this House resolution, which is a non-binding resolution, basically to castigate the BDS, the boycott movement that is designed to object to what Israel is doing outside of international law and in Palestine. And there were only 17 congressmen who voted no, one Republican and 16 Democrats, and Tulsi Gabbard not among them. And you wrote a beautiful piece, which we reposted on sort of There Goes Tulsi Gabbard. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, because first of all, I think there's something crucial that we need to point out here is that whether this resolution is binding or not binding, the exact words that they use, whether this resolution was in favor of a one-state solution or two-state, that's like, if you want the small print that nobody reads. What you really have, the purpose of such a resolution is very typically to force everybody to kneel, to accept, you know, to show submission and therefore become accomplice. I would make a parallel. The way, say, the Europeans reacted to the highly likely of the Skripal case, which was self-evidently idiotic, if you have any kind of knowledge about, you know, how things are done in the real world. Yet they all, in the name of solidarity, you know, said, yes, we're also going to introduce sanctions. We have something similar here. The point here is that I think that this resolution served a very important purpose, which is to prove that that Tulsi Gabbard does not have what it takes to say no to Israel lobby. That by itself is good enough already to justify that resolution from the point of view of their authors. And on top of that, it sort of gets Gabbard into the habit of complying, of bowing her head, of, you know, of knowing, you know, it's political expediency. She knows it's all lies and, you know, deception and hypocrisy, but she votes because she needs to do that in order to stay in the race. Therefore, you see, the system already corrupts her in order to make her go up. And that's how the system works. And this is what's so crucial. The system now is designed, that's why individuals don't matter anymore. They don't matter doesn't really matter who's in the White House, and doesn't really matter who's in the opposition, because individuals don't affect the system. We've seen that for so many individuals over the past decades, over and over and over and over. You know, you think, the perfect example is, you know, who is the most trusted, honest person possible? Colin Powell, you know. He was clearly the hero, the perfect guy. And then he shook the little, you know, water, what do you call it, the little, what's the name in English? You know, the UN one, he shook the little bottle with fake anthrax.
Yellow
in
cake.
There. I mean, even a guy like Colin Powell, you know, eventually they break him and he caves in. And they just did that with the one candidate who was truly against war. Everybody else, they're the same. I mean, this choice between Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. But Gabbard was the only one who was very distinctively different in her behavior. And sure enough, they broke her even before, you know, so high up upstream.
So here's the deal. I got run out of Washington by essentially these folks. You know, whether you want to call them the Zionists, the neocons, whatever you want to call them. But, you know, I'll call them transnational organized crime. They run the narcotics trafficking.
Very good definition.
Right. They run narcotics trafficking. They run, you know, and we've now allowed tremendous integration of our information systems with their intelligence services. You know, whether it's the British or the Israelis. God knows if we've let the Saudis in, I don't know. But if you just listen to half the rumors about the access they have to our information systems or NSA intelligence, et cetera, you know, there's an integration happening, which is very dangerous because we're integrating the power of government and the most powerful intelligence service capacities in the world with transnational organized crime.
Yep.
You know, so it's not surprising that transnational organized crime is out operating outside the law of international law. They don't believe in law. They got to where they are by breaking the law. That's what they're good at. And one of the things I know from dealing with them, you're talking about physical harassment. You're talking about, you know, information cyber harassment. You're talking about legal harassment, financial harassment. I put up a video the other day of Richard Pearl saying anybody who doesn't vote the way, I forget if it was AIPAC or somebody wants, you know, they'll lose their next election. And we've seen the video about Cynthia McKinney where, you know, she was targeted twice and run out of Congress twice by essentially that group. So you're talking about people who play dirty. And I think the question for everybody in America is, how are you going to stop them? That's why I think the fire commissioners are so absolutely brave. Because, you know, whatever those transnational organized crime elements are, they were clearly involved in 9/11. So the question is, how do we stand up to them?
Well, we could look at history because, for instance, what's happening now to the United States is not that different from what's taking place in the Soviet Union in the late 80s, and then even, I would say, the Yeltsin years.
Yeah, that's very true.
Russia was a complete colony. The country was basically completely colonized by the empire. The Constitution was written by quote-unquote American quote-unquote advisors. Russia underwent what the U.S. is undergoing right now, which is the later phase of the colonization is when it's actually, there's big coming out, and it becomes in your face and unapologetic. The only way to change that is regime change. I mean, I think this is the single most important thing that comes out of the Trump and Gabbard situation, which is that individuals don't make a difference anymore. Trump didn't, she didn't. To the extent that Obama had a little bit of honesty, maybe initially, maybe he tried, I'm not sure about that, but we can assume that. If he did try, he certainly failed. What we have here is basically an occupation government which rules against the will of the people of this country. And basically this country has been turned into a banana republic. The way to change that is regime change. There's no other example. I don't know of any example of that kind of, you know, of power structure willingly saying, oh, okay, well, you don't want us, we'll leave. That's not going to happen.
So here's the challenge of regime change. You have an entire system. So America breaks down to 3,100 counties. They are all dependent on the subsidy rolling out of the reserve currency, centrally controlled. So it's the central bank and the fiscal policy, which is why the budget is such a nightmare. The politics of the budget right now is a total nightmare, and the politics of the debt, and for this reason. You know, so you have to have 3,100 counties be prepared to re-engineer the money if you're going to have a regime change. You know, you need a bottom-up financial re-engineering to match a regime change. And everybody's sitting around praying that their cash flows continue when, in fact, those cash flows are financing something that's killing them.
Well, the regime change has to be not just, if you want, external. It has to be real. I mean, Putin came to power in Russia. And once he came to power, that was not regime change yet. The real regime change happened when he got rid of the oligarchs.
Right.
And that is something that we're just not going to see happening here.
It's not really regime change. What you're trying to do is you're trying to reverse a coup d'etat and return it to a constitutional republic. And you're trying to kick out transnational organized crime. In other words, you're trying to reassert the rule of law.
That's one option. There could be others. In theory, you could absolutely have a fascist kind of coup. You could have, in theory, a coup by the military. There are different options here. It all depends on individuals, on specific circumstances, and particularly what triggered the crisis. Because I think, you know, as long as the U.S. can print as much money as they want, and the rest of the world continues taking that money, it seems to me the system can continue for a long while. So the problem is what happens when people stop taking that money? And we see signs of that alternative being built. And once that happens, there's, you know, how is the saying in English? Victory has many parents, but defeat is orphan. The same thing is here. You know, when things go well, the ruling elites are all happy with each other and they all smile and they're acting very, very friendly. As soon as the system starts collapsing, they all get into a fight with each other. And then the friendliness goes away. And, you know, what you see is the real face of the system, which is, you know, violence and deception.
My nickname for that is the Midianite thing. And that's one of the reasons I think Epstein is in jail. They're trying to keep a lid on the Midianite thing. That's clearly a problem. Yeah.
There are fascinating rumors about that character, but I don't know if, which, you know, it's very secretive. We don't know what's really true or not.
Right. Right, I know. I strongly believe that a lot of the money that was laundered required a supporting control file operation. And I won't bore you with the details, but if you look at the people involved, I've always believed that the money coming out of HUD was part of what capitalized his operation and the Clinton Foundation essentially at the same time. And one of the reasons they canceled the HUD mortgage loan sales, I thought, was so they could use those mortgages, move them over to Epstein, and have that's where he got his financing from, is liquidating those mortgages. But it's a different conversation. Okay, let's keep going around the world, because Iran in the Middle East is far from the only hotspot. Have you been following Venezuela?
Yes, I have. And over there, I it's only the same thing, a complete failure of all American attempts to influence the events in a specific direction. It's kind of amazing. It really is amazing.
It's amazing because after all the threats and sort of very aggressive talk, suddenly it's complete quiet in the U.S. media. It's almost as though nobody wants to mention, uh-oh, it's not working.
Yeah, but that's the old approach. I mean, I don't know who it was, but I'm absolutely sure of that. There was an American general who said in the late 80s, early 90s, that we don't win unless CNN says we win. You know, it was one of his statements. I forgot the name of the man, unfortunately, but I never could find it again. But I remember that statement. Well, here we have the opposite. We're not defeated unless it says that we're defeated. So as long as the media gets the attention somewhere else on, you know, Putin eating babies for breakfast or Russia about to invade Poland and Portugal. So, you know, you just switch to something else once because it's embarrassing. I mean, this amnesia, the United States of amnesia, is absolutely crucial for this political stability of this country. Because if people had a memory and could track events over more than, say, a 1 week or 2 week attention span, then they would realize that the so-called indispensable nation fails at absolutely everything.
So one of the things we talked about the last time was how, you know, Trump, if Trump even attempted a land war, let alone a serious air war that, you know, Iran had retaliated a land war, it would cost him the election. I still believe that's the case. You know, I can't.
Look, his options are very limited. Of course, he can engage into a fictional airstrike. But for, as we know from Professor Marandi and many other people, I should tell you, I have correspondents in Iran. I correspond with them. These are knowledgeable people. And they all say unanimously the same thing. The mood is of extreme resistance. They are not going to cave in. They want to fight. They're ready to go. You know, they really are. They understand very, very well what's happening. The explanation by the media of what's happening with Iran is very, very good. So people understand and they're ready. They've been ready for it and preparing it for many, many years. So, right. You know, I don't see the point of a limited strike. A bigger strike, yes, you can actually achieve. Okay, let me just state something I state, I think, on every show. I don't believe there ever was a real Iranian nuclear weapons program, and I for sure believe that there's none today. For a host of reasons, including pragmatic military reasons that I can explain if you want, and because the Supreme Leader declared that nuclear weapons are haram and are not acceptable in Islam. So I don't believe that this has anything to do with nuclear weapons. However, it does have to do with forcing, you know, with beating down a successful Islamic Republic. I mean, that's the real problem of Iran. They make Israel look comparatively weaker. They have a lot of influence, economic influence, cultural, religious influence. This has been a successful society that's managed to build itself in the face of a never-ending, constant U.S. and Israeli attempted sabotage, disruption, and, you know, they managed to do it. So that the existence of Iran is even, I think, more offensive to the Anglo-Zionists than even the existence of Cuba.
Well, but how much of it is Israel wanting to be the hegemon in the Eurasia versus if Iran's relationship with China and Russia is highly successful, it dramatically impacts the equity ownership and other positions along the Silk Road. I mean, how much of this is really a battle with China?
I think it's secondary. I mean, the absolute crucial thing is that Israel is not the main regional power in the Middle East. And Israel is Israel is directly threatened by Iran, and not because of wiping anything off any kind of map. That's nonsense. But in their point of view, Iran refuses to accept a state for Jews only, and refuses to accept apartheid for the Palestinians, and therefore Iran must perish from an ideological point of view. From a military point of view, too, Iran is much more... remember, Israel and Saudi Arabia have no military that they can effectively use. They have a very expensive military. They have lots of advanced, fancy gear. But once push comes to shove and they have to fight, people are willing to resist, they're very bad. And that makes them very weak regionally. Whereas Iran is the opposite. Not only do they have a huge pool of Iranian forces they can send abroad of different... it can be from the Garden of the Revolution, from the military, etc. They also have economic ties, they have cultural ties, and they have allies who are by themselves very good fighters. I think of the, first of all, Hezbollah, obviously, but the Houthis also did a very good job fighting in Yemen. So these are actually, this is a state that can deliver.
So the Israelis and the Americans believe they can go very far on cyber warfare. They clearly believe that is their ace in the hole.
Oh, you know, I don't really believe that. I think it's the same as climate weapons and HARP and secret weapons and super duper, stealth aircraft and the space command that Trump created. This is all, this is all words. It's hot air. But if you look actually militarily, these systems you have to train, develop. There's a corporate culture. It takes decades to take that kind of changes.
Right.
And I think what they're doing is just, it's by the way, it's the opposite. It's the opposite with the Russian on the other side. Whatever happens, you accuse Russian hackers because you don't need any proof for it. You know, that's that simple. You just accuse Russian hackers. They did it. If we lost an election, Russian hackers. And the same way you can say we can blockade all of Russia and Iran. You know, I flip the switch and their entire electrical grid will go down. Well, do these people really think that Russians and Iranians are stupid and that their electrical grids are all that easy to do, to affect? I think it's nonsense. I think, again, it's propaganda. I think that 95% of the efforts of American politicians right now are directed at perception management, not at all at the real world.
Right. Well, but here's what you're saying, and I think it's really important to understand, which is reality is concrete. There's a concrete reality.
Yeah.
And ultimately, if you are going to dominate in a military capacity, you have to be effective at land war. You have to be able to control a territory.
Absolutely.
And that's what we're talking about. Who's got the capacity to implement, effect, and win a land war? And the United States does not. And the United States, combined with its allies to the extent that they're willing to support us, also does not.
That's true.
And,
it is absolutely true.
Right. And for some reason...
that really is a huge threat because nobody's afraid. I mean, coming back to those secret weapons and advanced capabilities, in Venezuela, I think there was two or three cases of electrical power grid being sabotaged. And as far as I know, regular explosives were used. So that should tell you something right here. You know, if you have to put an explosive on something, it means it wasn't a cyber thing, anything. It's just you. It's basically sabotage. Good old-fashioned World War II style sabotage. Nothing wrong with it. But I mean, and that's in a small country. Look, if the Americans were so powerful, there would be no electricity all over Venezuela immediately.
Right. Exactly.
Why isn't it happening?
Exactly.
Well.
Exactly.
And now they're going to tell me they're going to disconnect all of Iran or all of Russia? Please.
I don't know. You know, I find the whole situation baffling. Here's what I can't understand. I've been in Europe for a month, and I keep running into different conversations about what's going on in the Middle East. And, you know, I finally sat down yesterday, and I said, I just don't understand Israel, because why would you inflict this much pain trying to force the United States to start a war that it's going to lose?
Yeah, but in that sense, Israel is no different from the U.S. I mean, the general public has been so rendered so passive and ignorant that they don't realize when the real risks are taken that they can pay for it. They're unaware of it.
Right.
And Israel, basically, remember, it's a highly ideological country. It's a country in which ideological dogmas are presented as axiomatic truth that cannot be you know, for instance, Jews are superior and smarter and all the rest of the stuff. And the only language the Arabs understand is violence. I mean, all these typical racist cliches, if that's where your thoughts are, you won't be able to be swayed away from it by reality. I mean, when the Nazis started losing the war against the Soviet Union, they didn't go, I think our racial theories are probably nonsense. They didn't do that. They might have thought it. They might have thought it even before they did the start of the war. But the ideological imperative is such, particularly collapsing society, that if you express criticism or doubts of that ideology, what happens? You're declared a traitor. It becomes a crime to be critical.
But here's the thing. We do have a group of people leading a country whose experience is that lawlessness has worked. So one of my theories is one of the reasons that they have been able to build such a political coalition in the United States is they've been very effective online at getting control files, including using things like pornography. So, you know, I think there's been a very significant covert effort to centralize control. And, you know, people who've been good at organized crime have been good at doing it. So I just think lawlessness has worked.
Yes, but the other tool that the empire uses is corruption. The U.S. is the world expert for sure on the ability to corrupt people. The CIA, most of their successes actually are not due to, you know, brilliant intelligence work, but basically because a lot of their officers are giving the task to basically offer straightforward bribes, and it works. It's nothing very sophisticated. If you've got a printing press and you can print as much money as you want, it's not no problem to hand out as much money as you want. That's how it works. But the adversaries that the United States dealt with over the years were very different from those that they have against them today. That's crucial. And really, there was a qualitative change.
So let's turn to Europe, because we're having a turnover in leadership in Europe. We have a new president of the EU. We have a new president of the ECB. Europe's in the middle of this thing because part of the challenge of the Silk Road is Asia's rising and Eurasia's right smack between the world's biggest consumer market and Asia. So Europe's in this mix, and Europe has been exceptionally obedient to the United States. But we also see the Anglo-American alliance with Brexit breaking away from the EU. So we have new EU leadership. What's the EU? The EU has a role to play in this because they're right smack in the middle.
Well, the EU is sort of like an aging call girl. They don't know how much, you know, how attractive they still are and how much money they can get for their services. And they're dealing with now a boss which basically is sort of essentially left the room. So there is, of course, chaos in Europe. There is transition, but for the time being, I still don't see meaningful regime change. I see, you know, there are signs and indications that there is a change in happening progressively, but it has been going for a while. I mean, the EU has lost pretty much every popular vote it dared to do. We still haven't reached a point of true explosion, and I think this is probably where Europe is headed. There needs to be a real crisis for Europe to start recovering sovereignty, because right now it's terminal.
Well, if there's a war in Iran and somebody is foolish enough to drop a nuclear bomb, I mean, Israel has nuclear bombs, the U.S. has nuclear bombs. If somebody's foolish enough to drop a nuclear bomb, Israel is the one that's going to pay, not North America.
Well, the big price, first of all, I don't disagree that there's a risk of use of nuclear weapons. I'm always irritated when, you know, people irresponsibly say that nuclear weapons have been used in Syria and Lebanon and Yemen and Iraq. That's not true. But is there a risk of use of nuclear weapons? Yes, particularly in the context of a failed limited. I don't think the U.S. will ever invade Iran as an entire country. But I think there is a risk if there's a shooting war starting of a limited ground operation to clear to basically go and destroy the Iranian infrastructure along the Strait of Hormuz. So a limited, limited would be actually huge. We're talking about easily, you know, 80,000 people at least involved in that kind of attack.
Saker, what's the most that Israel can field in a land army?
In Iran, nothing, because Iran is way too far. You need to project
right.
your ground forces. So you can't just take an armored brigade and go boom and fly it 1,000
right.
miles
right.
up north. It doesn't work. So no, nothing. Israel
right.
can reach Iran with missiles and aircraft only. But it's okay. but it's irrelevant because think what happened in 2006 with Hezbollah. That's exactly what we're looking at. We're looking at a repeat of that, but on a much bigger, much more bloody scale. So that's really the risk. And I think at that point, the U.S. would be more likely, actually, to use a tactical nuke to sort of try to shock and awe the Iranians, which is not going to work either. But I think they're perfectly capable of doing that. And they admitted to it. Cheney was asked during the first Gulf War, what would happen if the Iraqis crossed the line and attacked the 82nd Airborne, which is light infantry? And he said, well, the idea was that the Navy would use embarked aircraft to protect them. If that didn't work, tactical nukes. So US has always been looking at nukes with a desire to find a way to use them. And a humiliating defeat would be exactly the kind of circumstance which would press a narcissistic and weak people like what we have now in the White House to go, fine, we'll nuke them if that's what they want. But the problem is what
so
happens
here's
right
the
after
thing.
They nuke them.
The problem is not that the people in the White House are going to want to do it. It's the people who are, who've got the gun to their head, whoever that is, who do it. And you don't have a Tillerson, you don't have a Mattis, you don't have a Coates there to stop it. And that gets back to the question of who's forcing this? Who's behind the scenes? And who, because, Trump did not come in with a mandate to continue war in the Middle East. Quite the opposite.
I think that, first of all, the biggest consequence of using a nuclear weapon would not be military, actually. I think there would be an absolute collapse of the empire pretty fast because of the outrage this would trigger worldwide. The Europeans would go bananas, I think, if the United States starts using nukes anywhere. So I think the price would be horrendous in terms of political price to pay. But, I'm afraid that there's so much arrogance and imperial hubris in the mindset of U.S. Military personnel that I think that if most generals, if you ask them, your choice is either to suffer a defeat or use a tactical nuke, which you think you would go with. I think the vast majority will say, use a tactical nuke. Anything but not...
Really?
I don't want the world to know that I'm weak.
So basically what you're saying is it's either use a tactical nuke or lose the reserve currency.
That is one possibility. You can also lose the currency without using a nuke, but I don't see any chance of success for any kind of military operation against Iran right now. And depending on how hard Iran hits back, once they fully get, it's the front of their nose, they realize they really have no good options. I think out of sheer anger, hubris, and panic, they are capable of using tactical nukes. Yes, absolutely.
So this gets back again to who are the people behind the scenes who are pushing this?
I think it's, again, not people. I think it's the system that breeds that. The system has its own internal logic, an ideological logic. And under that logic, the indispensable nation shall not be defeated, period. This is not negotiable.
We've been defeated constantly. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Look, the perfect example is, I have heard that many times from military personnel, we never lost a battle in Vietnam. We lost the war because of the P-6 and the hippies, but we never lost the war militarily. These people don't understand a simple premise. Basic fundamental reality is that wars are a continuation of politics by other means. You can destroy or kill an N number of people or hardware. If you haven't achieved the means of your victory, you lost.
Right. You lost.
And this is the same thing here.
Yeah, we lost the war.
Even when you win.
Yeah, right. Well, we clearly lost the war in Vietnam. And it wasn't because of the hippies and the P-6. Right. Yes, absolutely. I totally agree. I totally agree.
I mean, the true history of the Grenada invasion really has to be written. Because it's even better than what people say. It's just absolutely unbelievable what happened there. And that's Grenada. Grenada, that's...
I know.
And they want to take on Iran? The people who train Hezbollah and the Houthis? I mean, come on. Seriously? 80 million?
I don't see how anybody is going to occupy and control a country of 80 million without,
Oh, occupy and control is not going to happen. That's not even...
Right.
That's not even rumor. The biggest they could do is... Okay, the hardest they can do is sustained you know, what they did in Kosovo, essentially, on a possibly even bigger scale, that kind of hammering. Because what you do, you first hit the military infrastructure, quote unquote, and then you go on to the rest, you know, that supports the military. Basically, it's the old thing, and it was like this from the Indian Wars. If you can't get the fighters, get their families, their villages, their infrastructure. That's what was done to Serbia. When the U.S. was unable to defeat the Serbian military, what did they do? They hit the people of Serbia and Montenegro. It's always the same thing.
Right.
Israel has been doing in Lebanon for years.
Right.
It's basically taking civilians hostage and making them pay. I think it's one good definition of terrorism.
Right. The war of terrorism. So let's also touch base on the Ukraine.
Okay.
So Trump has basically turned to Europe and say, it's your problem. What is Europe going to do?
Well, first of all, Europe can't do anything. And frankly, neither can the U.S. Again, there's an assumption of action, of agency, of ability to do something, really. But I don't think there's much anybody can do about the Ukraine at this point. And it's a failed state. That's a done deal. The last election was absolutely amazing because twice all the nationalists, all the neo-Nazis got huge slap in the face by the people. The people clearly are fed up. But there's nothing they can do because the power of the real power in the Ukraine is not the power of the vote, but the power of the mob, of the street. And the guys who put Poroshenko into power are all still there. They haven't lost a single fighter. So now Zelensky has to choose between, you know, doing the will of the people and facing real, real physical threat for him and his regime, or do the will of the Nazis. But then, you know, be as hated as Poroshenko was, which is probably what he's going to do. And I think that's where he's headed. He's going to do a repeat of Poroshenko Light, that appears for the time being. It's hard to tell. The guy is completely unpredictable, having no record.
So let me turn to the Empire's parallel universe. We're seeing, in all these different situations, we're seeing the Empire, you know, say one thing, and we're watching a totally different reality. There's a multiple personality disorder, which is more extreme than we've ever seen it. And one of the ways, one of the symptoms of that is you're watching behavior in the United States. You know, I've been in Europe for 4 weeks, and it's such a relief because there is so much incoherence in the United States. It really makes it hard to manage day to day to day. And you watch in the media debates and discussions of total irrelevant issues and sort of he said, she says, while at the same time in the budget and in the debt spiral, you're watching the economic model really under extreme stress and pressure. And so we have this reality of what's really happening to the empire under extreme financial stress and pressure. And on the other hand, we have a complete inability to deal with reality. It's almost like watching the Salem witch trials. No, truly. I don't know. I went back and I did.
You're absolutely right. I'm laughing because it's true.
I did an analysis of the Salem witch trials long ago. And one of the things I discovered was you had two groups. One was sort of an older cost plus model. And the other was sort of new and young and entrepreneurial. And they were under extreme stress because the Brits were talking about pulling their charter. The Indians were, you know, thinking of invading, and you had real extraordinary economic difficulty, people trying to get enough to eat. And right in the middle of it, a preacher shows up who's been promised a certain amount of tithes, and he's not getting his tithes. And suddenly he starts, you know, talking about the stories of the witches that the kids have made up, and suddenly his tithes shoot up because it's phenomenally entertaining. And so you get somebody in the entertainment business who's making money from entertainment, and then you're off to the races. And so the two groups fight, and they fight by killing each other's women. And that's, it was just a way of them fighting. But what they were doing during the fight was ignoring the real problem, which was the Indians and the pulling of the charter. And it was really interesting. Do you know how it stopped?
No.
Very interesting. So finally, somebody said, you know, if we all keep going to trial or being in the jury instead of planting, we're going to starve next winter.
Yeah.
And so
somebody has to plant. Yep.
Right. Somebody has to plant food and somebody has to be productive or else we're all going to starve. And that's what ended the Salem witch trials. And there are these two tsunamis coming at each other. One of the fundamental economics and the falling productivity, and the other of a group of people who, you know, I don't know how to explain it, but they're involved in serious distraction and it's getting worse as they fight. And the question is, how do you turn that and focus people on dealing with the real issues? Because at some point, everybody's going to have to eat. And if there's no food, it's a big problem.
Yeah, but I think this is, again, something very typical of terminal ideological society. You know, when you have a complete inadequacy between what's discussed and what the public problems are and what the real problems are. I mean, look at all the regimes when they're falling. I mean, again, I think of the Tsarist regime and then the Kerensky and then actually the Soviets and the Nazis. They all went through that period. There's a moment when you're in extreme decline and you're going into deep delusion and some magic thing will save you. You know, and nothing magical will happen. We're really repeating the Titanic experience here completely. We have an orchestra playing and, you know, a captain that's gone and basically the ship is sinking, but most people, you know, are still dancing to the music.
Well, but it's interesting, you know, throughout the ship, there's an exceptional amount of serious talent which has been sidelined, whether it's competent bureaucrats leaving because they won't play the game, or state and local officials who are still trying to hold things together. Throughout the system, you have an enormous amount of productive people, and they've been sidelined. And if they were put back in control of the nuts and bolts throughout the society, you could get an enormous leap forward in productivity, let alone if they were allowed to just to be, I mean, if you look at all the different ways the productive are trained in the United States, it's extraordinary that they don't give up.
That's another thing that's common to terminal regimes, is that the system basically isolates and removes from position of influence all the skilled people, the talented, the principled, the decent one, and promotes only the scum, the idiots, the confused, or the blackmailable. That's also something very typical. It's nothing unique that happened here. It happens all over the place. By the way, Europe is pretty much in the same condition. The elites there are just terrible.
Right.
And in spite of the fact that, and that's exactly one of those very fundamental diagnostic tools, when you see all the people that could make a difference being moved away and replaced by non-entities, that's also a very, very worrisome sign.
I don't know. You know, I know how productive the system could be if that top 10% was allowed to be back running, you know, their pieces. It's quite remarkable, because when you run organizations, you know, because I've run businesses and I've run government agencies, and when the 10% of the slugs, and if you look at the neocons, they are slugs par excellence. When you let the slugs run thing, you know, the organization quickly disseminates into just, you know, swamp and mess, and it's disgusting. And you think, oh, this thing is hopeless. We have to let it collapse. If you literally come in, put the 10% productive in charge and get the 80% of the followers following, that's what nobody gets. 80% of the people are following around who's ever in charge. And if you can swing out the slugs and put in the productive people, it's like magic. It's unbelievable. But the question is, you know, if the slugs have organized to be very good at killing, poisoning, beating, threatening, you know, et cetera, and we have been invaded by transnational organized crime and we don't know how to deal with it. And we're going to have to figure it out or we're going to go down. So
I think the only way to figure it out is to go down. And then what happens after you go down, there is this collapse. Then the first generation to come, the actual regime changers, usually overdo it. There's a lot of ideology coming from the regime changers, and only the second generation starts being much more responsible. And you know, there's more statecraft usually after a very long period. I mean, comparatively short but very painful period of transition, because regime change means right. regime down, then chaos, and then rebuild. And that cycle, which can last 20 years, can be really right. painful. I mean, that can be almost as bad as a war.
So here's my concern. My concern, if you wait all the way to go down the way you did in Russia, you know, the psychopaths have stolen a great deal of money. They're going to have a field day. If you listen to some of the trial balloons I've listened to of doing the rape of Russia here, you know, that collapse means they get to buy everything at 10 cents on the dollar. And, you know, they're going to double down on their profits and control.
Yes, so absolutely true.
Right, which is why...
And we know who's going to be doing the buying, because the only people who have a lot of disposable income will be the Chinese in that circumstance.
Right. Well, no. You're going to have the people who stole all the... No, the guys who engineered the financial coup are sitting with an absolute stockpile. Huge stockpile. In fact, a bigger stockpile probably than the Chinese. But there's no doubt the Chinese are going to be big buyers.
Yeah, but see, but if there's a regime change, there's going to be hell to pay for those who are in the old regime. Typically, they get dispossessed, shot, jailed, exiled, their assets get seized. I mean, there's hell to pay after you've been, you know, caught basically being a parasite for decades.
Right. And, you know, one of my theories about Brexit is I think that's one of the reasons the British are so eager to protect the secrecy in the offshore havens. No, really.
Really?
I think, yeah. The Queen's no fool.
Yep. They didn't become who they were by being dumb. Agreed.
Right, exactly. So, Saker, let's look forward for the next 3 months until you're back with us. Tell us about you, what you're going to be doing, what you're going to be researching, what you're going to be writing. We want to know what you're looking at.
Well, my two big ones remain Iran and the Ukraine for different reasons, but those are the two that I find are most... you know, most interesting because most concerning, I mean, I should say. I think that's, I think the Zelensky thing, the chances that he will do something meaningful are just melting by the minute. I mean, he's not done much, but everything he's done has been really bad and incompetent. So I think the Ukraine is headed for complete chaos. Iran, I would say, again, never say never, but at this point in time, I don't see a workable solution to attack Iran, so I think they would have to fold. So the big issue is, will Israel have the means to force the U.S. to do its dirty job for it? And I don't know. This is something I cannot answer.
See, I would say no, but they're going to do everything in their power to, and I think they're going to do a lot of... I think they're going to kill a lot of people. I think it's going to be a very ugly fight.
You mean in covert operations and murder of scientists, or you mean airstrikes on the...
No, I mean trying to get their way in terms of policy in the U.S. government and U.S. politics.
Well, don't they already have total control? I mean, is there anything... What is it that they don't control?
I don't think they have total control yet. I think they're still... significant interests that don't want them to have total control. So I think
right.
they represent a faction, but I don't think they control all the levers of power. And I think, I think we see lots of different symptoms that there's a fight going on. And I think that fight's going to get worse.
If it is true, that's what's happening, then I'd really explain to you that resolution recently. Because if there's a fight, then what they need is to get all the potential opponents, like Tulsi Gabbard, to kneel, to bow down their head and to get her in a habit of don't mess with the Israel lobby because you're going to be dead. And if that's effectively, if they pursue that further effectively, there's going to be absolutely no change as long as they're anywhere near the White House. And I don't see anybody removing them either. So that's why I think there's... I don't see any kind of...
Well, it's interesting. I read your coverage of the vote, and I proceeded to find Thomas Massey's website, learn all about him, and give him a $100 donation.
Okay.
any Republican who votes no on that resolution deserves a reward, don't you think?
I do, but on the other hand, I need to look at the rest of his votes, and he's still within the Republican Party. Look at Ron Paul. God knows that is an honest uh-huh. man, but the fact that he was sitting in that party, you know, he was limited in what he could do.
Right. Right. Well, I would say that for both of those parties.
Totally true.
Right. It's Massey's record's pretty impressive. I did not know a lot about him. I followed Rand Paul, but I didn't know about Massey. Okay, well, what can we do?
Did he offer any explanation for his vote?
Not that I know of. He was in the, his big focus was on the budget bill, and he introduced amendment and got 47 votes to change the name of the bill to the Kick the Can and Other Items Bill. So,
Definitely look him up.
Yeah, he's quite interesting. He runs a cattle ranch in Kentucky, and he's a engineer trained at MIT. So I think he built all the solar on his own ranch.
That sounds interesting.
Yeah, he's.
So I'll be observing that with interest too.
Yeah, but I agree with you. You need much greater, deeper fundamental change. One person can't do this.
Yeah.
So I'm not saying, you know, I always believe it makes a difference to have a good person. But, you know, this is a systemic, and this goes to the heart of what I call the central banking warfare model. And those issues have to be dealt with. And one person, you know, winning this election or that election can't change it.
Not at all.
Okay, well, Saker, I want to just say before we end, two of the most gratifying experiences of my life was reading The Essential Saker 1 and The Essential Saker 2. And I'm thoroughly enjoying the start of Essential Saker 3. And I have to just recommend to subscribers, if you haven't discovered Saker's books, I really encourage you to do so. And also at his website, he has a community, and there's regular posting, but very rich discussion, The Vineyard of the Saker. And I strongly recommend you access those books. You know, you're going to have to read them. You're going to have to put them books on tape, Saker.
That's a lot of reading.
I know. But it's, you know, if you're on those long drives, they're fantastic.
You know, I wish I had the time to do that. I really would love to.
Well, what you need to do, you see, your voice is so great, because if you combine the content with your voice, you know, it's absolutely, but you need to find somebody in your wide audience who's, you know, who could do a really good job of reading. And because I think people would really enjoy listening to them. You know, a lot of my subscribers listen when they're commuting to work and back and forth.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, Americans drive. So, yeah, we'll see. Somebody will emerge from the Vineyard of the Saker community to do that for you. Okay?
God will. Yes.
We're willing. We're willing for them to merge.
Absolutely.
Okay, Saker, any last thoughts before we finish?
No, that's it. Let's see what happens on those two countries. And hopefully you're right that there's still a part of the country that's sovereign here. Could make a huge difference.
So, absolutely. Let's just keep praying for peace. Can't hurt.
Yep.
Right? Okay.
That's it.
Prayers for peace. Saker, thank you very much for joining us on the Saleria Report. You have a wonderful quarter, okay?
You too. Thank you so much for inviting me. It's a pleasure each time. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening on the Saleria Report. As I close every time, don't ask if there is a conspiracy. Clearly, if you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one, because we're going to have to reorganize the economy of the United States. But we can do it. Let's do it. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.